Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is the Klickenhaus v. Household International. Mr. Clement.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Paul Clement for the appellates. I will endeavor to save 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This lawsuit was filed in 2002, and in the decade or more of proceedings that have followed have been riddled with errors. But in our appellate briefing, we have focused on errors that go to three critical elements of plaintiff's case: loss causation, who is the maker of a particular misrepresentation, and the issue of reliance. Now, I want to start about talking about loss causation, which really is the error that we think pervaded the entire proceedings, but I want to make sure I have time to talk about what is probably the even more straightforward basis for ordering a new trial here, which is the Janus error. But let me start with loss causation. The plaintiffs had two different models designed to prove loss causation for each of these statements in this case. Both of them shared a common defect, which is they assumed inflation at the beginning of the class period rather than demonstrating where the inflation came in the first place. And that is a particularly significant problem, I think, with respect to the so-called leakage model as opposed to the specific disclosures model. The principal problem here, I think, is illustrated by the fact that we're talking about a leakage model, which is already on the periphery of what we understand as a classic securities case. This classic securities case is you have a misrepresentation. It makes the stock price go up, and you can see the inflation in the stock price. Then the stock trades at an inflated level, and then there's a disclosure where you see the inflation come out of the stock. Now, the Supreme Court, in a case like Dura, acknowledges, it doesn't specifically endorse, but acknowledges the possibility that, well, maybe rather than the information coming out in one fell swoop with one disclosure, it can leak out over time. But what the plaintiffs want to do here is say, by showing how it leaked out over time, we can obviate the need to ever show where it came in the first place.
I thought this was litigated on a theory of price inflation maintenance, as opposed to price inflation in the first instance, or is that not clear?
Well, that is far from clear, and I think that even at this late stage in the proceedings, the plaintiffs really haven't picked a horse on that. Now, I think that's problematic. I think either way you look at this, there you'd still have to have one theory or the other, and with either theory there's a problem. But even if it's a so-called inflation maintenance theory, I still think there ought to be an obligation to show loss causation where the inflation came in. Even if it came in outside the class period, and their theory is that it was maintained by a misrepresentation in the class period, I still think you need to show where it came in the first instance.
Well, why would that be with that particular theory of loss causation? It seems to me that in the Schleicher case, we suggested that theory sort of takes as a given that the price is inflated and that the loss causation concept is addressed from the standpoint of when the misrepresentations were made and maintained the inflated price, which otherwise would have dropped had the truth been told.
Your Honor, I don't think Schleicher addresses this question of whether in a inflation maintenance theory you have to show when it first came in. Because even if the idea is it is a misrepresentation that stops that stock from going lower, there, still, presumably, that corresponds to some misrepresentation that made it trade higher. And that's, I think...
Well, it's an omission. It's a concealment of the truth is the theory here, that the price was inflated. We know that because it dropped during the disclosure period at a rate that was more than twice what other entities in this sector were experiencing, so it can't be explained away by general market trends, and so there's got to be some explanation for that, and the model is intended to address that explanation.
Well, Your Honor, this is why I think it's critical for them to have actually presented one theory or the other. But even in this inflation maintenance theory, I don't think they've said that this is an omission case. They've never suggested that. This is a misrepresentation case. Now, I think their original theory was the inflation came into the stock because there was representations about this being a growth company and they were going to launch on a growth path, and that then questions became raised about, well, are you engaging in some unlawful conduct? And then they say, no, we're not doing predatory lending. And I still think then you would want them to show where it came in so you could have some discipline about showing whether it came out based on the revelation of that fraud or based on other specific factors. And I do want to be emphatic that with respect to the leakage model in particular, which the jury bought, there's nothing that disciplines them to make sure that this model accounts for firm-specific non-fraud factors. And that is absolutely critical under the Dura case. And at least in the specific disclosures model, you have some discipline, because there they say, okay, on a particular date, inflation came out based on a disclosure that is relevant to the fraud. But with respect to the leakage model, they don't do that. What they do, I think it's quite simple, is they look at the overall price drop of the stock, they adjust for the overall drop in the stock market as a whole, and then they adjust for an industry index, and then they're done.
Right. I mean, there's no question that the leakage model in particular doesn't account for firm-specific reasons for the drop. That's clearly not part of the model. So you're asking for a ruling that forecloses the use of this economic model to measure loss causation?
We are looking for a ruling that would foreclose the use of a model that doesn't account for non-fraud firm-specific information.
So it's not good enough to have the experts say, I took into account firm-specific explanations and ruled them out because there were some that went up, some that went down, and they canceled each other out. I think
certainly not enough to say that they canceled each other out. Now, I think that's true at a broader level, which is that, you know, they just don't magically cancel each other out. But to be specific, I still think there's a problem in this case with that testimony, because all that's saying is that over the course of the class period, the positive news and the negative news canceled each other out. But what that still allows, and we illustrate very specific example in footnote 4 of our opening brief, is a situation where somebody buys, and you know, here there's just to be concrete, there's a 10-day period in July of 2002 where there's no misrepresentation and no disclosure, but based on this model, there's $2.50 of inflation that come into the stock. Now, somebody who bought on July 5th and sold on July 14th would recover, even though there's no misrepresentation and there's no disclosure. It's just an artifact of this model. It's purely firm-specific, non-fraud information. So even if that's canceled out later in the class period, that's not a solution to this problem. And we think that Dura is quite specific, that it's the plaintiff's burden to foreclose this kind of firm-specific, non-fraud factors.
Right. There's no question about that. But the question in this case is, how does the plaintiff carry that burden, whether it has to be built into the economic model itself or whether it can be addressed by way of expert testimony that accounts for it in a different way. In other words, not a non-statistical way, but a testimonial way.
I think it would have to be built into the model. I think that's the right rule of law, but I would say that even if you think it's possible to do it through non-statistical testimony, you need something more than they canceled each other out, especially when you have a case where you can demonstrate that that's not good enough, because you'd still have people who could recover and show loss causation based on non-fraud factors that have nothing to do with any misrepresentation or any disclosure whatsoever. So we think that that is a fundamental problem. We do think that, you know, you certainly could decide this case on a way that you ordered a new trial with the suggestion that maybe the specific disclosure model would have been sufficient, because I think there are still problems with the specific disclosure model, but it at least tethers the disclosures to the fraud, because it basically looks through the period and says every time there is a statistically significant drop in the price on the date of a disclosure, we're going to tally that up.
Right, but that understates loss causation, or at least potentially understates loss causation in a case like this where some of this information was potentially known by industry actors not specifically disclosed.
With respect, I think if it was known by industry actors, that meant it leaked out and you should have been able to show that. And if you can't show that, that's because it actually is already in the market. And so, you know, there were other disclosure days, for example, where they looked and there was either no statistically significant movement of the price or it actually moved the other way. And that shows that as to that disclosure, the market must have already known it if we're going to be here on the assumption that we have fraud in the market. So, but I guess what I would say is this, Your Honor. Even if there's some possibility that the specific disclosure model might underestimate what leaks out, there is no question that the leakage model systematically overestimates it because it takes into account these non-fraud firm-specific matters. And then, in a sense, this becomes very clearly demonstrated with the specific verdict here because the jury assigns the sum total of inflation that's attributed to all three fraud theories to a single statement on March 23, 2001 that only goes to predatory lending. Now, that can't be right. I mean, we describe that as essentially a Comcast error, and I think it is that. But it also shows the broader problem with the model, because when you use the model in this way, it became inevitable that they would attribute things to that March 23rd statement that had nothing to do with predatory lending, because the model attributes everything.
Right. But 3 days later, or 3 business days later, there's a 10K filing that contains all three species of fraud?
That's right. And that just demonstrates that the jury did think there were three species of fraud here. It thought that they all contributed to inflation, but yet
so
on
we
March
can't
23rd.
Just lop off those 3 days. And
with all due respect, Your Honor, I think you know you can't just lop off 3 days. That wouldn't work on a remitter, and I've never heard of anything that would be so inconsistent with the Seventh Amendment as to say, well, you know, if the jury had come out on the 28th of March instead of the 23rd of March, we might not have the problem being this evident. I think what I would leave you with, though, is on this, is the idea that if it had happened on the 28th, it wouldn't mean, you wouldn't have the same glaring problem. I don't know that I'd be able to label the problem a Comcast problem, but you would still have the same basic problem, which is everything goes into this model, including the non-fraud firm-specific information, which is a problem under Dura.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, They can't work in conjunction, both models, and they're separate, as you see.
They are separate models, and then the way that this jury was instructed, they were specifically told to pick one or the other. And so we'd obviously have a different suite of appellate arguments if they'd picked the specific disclosures model. We'd also have a radically lower verdict against my client if they'd picked that model. So I think the way to think about it is if you think that the leakage model is problematic, the specific disclosure model might have been okay, then the proper remedy is a new trial.
I know you want to get to your other arguments, but before we leave this topic, I didn't read the closing arguments. What was the defense approach or theory of lost causation here? There must have been some explanation offered to the jury for why the stock dropped at so significantly higher a rate than other sector entities.
And it was essentially, first of all, you know, obviously most of the closing argument was spent saying there's no liability
fraud,
here
right.
at all and all of that, and then some of it was saying they've only offered you, you know, these theories and these theories don't work. And I think the real idea was that what's going on here is you're in a market where you have, there's concerns with what, you know, we refer to as headline risk. And it is certainly not good for a company to be investigated by state attorneys general and the like. And that's not just the fraud. I mean, it's just bad news for any company. And then I think if you think about their own theory of this case, there's a reason why you would expect a company like Household's price to fall more than the industry average, which is it had been identified as a growth stock. It had certainly picked up at a higher rate when times were good than the rest of the industry. And then when, you know, the whole industry goes through a bad patch and Household, for firm-specific reasons that are not completely tethered to the fraud, goes through a bad patch, you'd expect it to drop at a greater rate. And that's why I think I'll just sum up with this. I think what you have here is you have exactly what the Supreme Court was worried about in Dura. You have a price drop, and it's just not good enough to say, okay, well, I'm going to take out the fact that the whole market dropped, and I'm going to take out the fact that the industry dropped, and everything that's left I get to count as my inflation. So let me turn, if I could, then to the Janus error, because although we think in some respects the loss causation problems are what really explains this enormous verdict, we do think that the Janus error is, in fact, the more straightforward basis for ordering a new trial in any event. The jury here was instructed before the Janus decision. The error was properly preserved, and we think the jury was instructed in a way that is fundamentally incompatible with Janus. And then the only question I think becomes at that point is whether there is prejudice. And there is clearly prejudice in this case, and I think you see it most clearly from the all-important March 23rd jury finding. because there is a statement that is made by Mr. Gilmer in the Janus sense. It is specifically attributed to Gilmer. And remember that the court in Janus goes out of its way to say that when a statement is specifically attributed to someone, it is a fair inference that they made it and that they made it solely. So this is Gilmer's statement in the Janus sense. He's found to be reckless. Aldinger, who did not make the statement in the Janus sense, is found to be knowing. Now, that kind of disconnect is possible in a world pre-Janus. But after Janus, we would respectfully suggest you don't get to that result. It is surely evidence, which is all we need to show, that the erroneous instruction prejudiced the proceedings, and it prejudiced, obviously, the individuals who are being held liable for statements they didn't make.
Maybe so for Gilmer, but not the others?
Oh, yes, the others as well. As to that statement, it's most obvious as to Gilmer. But if you look at the other statements, for example, you have a statement that's made by Aldinger. Now, the jury holds both Gilmer and Schoenholtz responsible for the statement that only Aldinger made at an investment conference. You likewise have a statement that Schoenholtz makes at a different investment conference.
Mr. Clement, you're into your rebuttal time.
Okay.
You can use it if you want.
Thank you for that. I want to save the rebuttal. I would simply say, though, that it is important to recognize as well that that with respect to Household as well, there's prejudice because that Aldinger finding on the 23rd is the only basis for a knowing finding against Household, and that is the only basis for joint and several liability against Household. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dowd.
Good morning, Your Honors. I may have pleased the Court. Mike Dowd for the plaintiffs' appellees. Your Honors, I just heard Mr. Clement say, as he stood up, something about a classic securities case. And it just made me think, you know, this case, we picked a jury 5 years ago, and that was after 7 years of pretrial litigation. And one of the first things that jury heard in this case is that at the beginning of the class period, the defendants looked at their stock price and said, it's trading way too low. We're in the 30s. We could get the stock price up to 66. It should trade $22 more per share if we could convince Wall Street that we can grow. And they convinced Wall Street about their growth through the use of predatory lending, through hiding their delinquency statistics, and through accounting fraud. That's what they did. And then the stock grew, just like they said, up over $22 per share increase. And then when the defendants got it to a point where they knew the fraud couldn't be sustained, they tried to sell the company to Wells Fargo. And if they had completed that sale, each of these three defendants, between them, they would have pocketed $150 million personally. And instead, Wells Fargo saw the scam inside Household's books. And what happened is, as the truth emerged, the stock dropped. The stock dropped as the truth emerged, back down, and our expert said $23 per share. It was like the defendants predicted exactly how much they could trick the markets, and then at the end, when the truth emerged, it came down that exact amount. I don't think that's a coincidence. It's a classic securities fraud. And this was a rational jury, Your Honors, a rational jury. They didn't find liability for the plaintiffs until March of 2001. After that time, they carefully went through the false statements. They found 17 in favor of the plaintiffs and 10 others they found in favor of the defendants.
But that $23 figure, whatever, wasn't derived by the jury. It was one of three offered to them, right?
Yes, it was one of three offered to the jury, and that's the one that the jury chose. I think I'd like to address first the loss causation argument. And I think, you know, the defendants say we have to prove loss causation and that they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Dura requires that the plaintiffs show the defendants made a misrepresentation that inflated the stock price and that thereafter the truth became generally known and as a result the share value depreciated. And that's exactly what we did. And there was more than one type of loss causation evidence in this case. I mean, the first thing that the jury looked at, undoubtedly, were the defendants' analysis at the time, their contemporaneous analysis of why did this stock drop. And the defendants' internal investor relations reports from that time period in August of 2002 looked back at the last 4 months and said, why is the stock price declining? And they cited a series of articles that had leaked, principally about the Washington Department of Financial Institutions report and how it was coming out, and then Household got an injunction, and then analysts reacted to that. And finally, the report came out and said that there was pervasive fraud. And the defendants attributed the vast majority of a $22 stock decline at that time to the revelation of that information about predatory lending. Certainly, the jury could look at that for loss causation. Secondly, the jury could look at what market analysts thought. And the market analysts all were downgrading household. They were saying, well, if there's predatory lending and they have to stop those practices, we don't know if their model, their business model is even sustainable. And therefore, they downgraded, and that caused stock declines. And then you had the specific disclosure model, where our expert, Professor Fischel, that they called the gold standard in front of the jury, he identified 14 specific disclosures that he tied to the frauds and said those show loss causation. And finally, he identified in the leakage quantification model a cascade of negative information, the same type of information that the defendants pointed to in their internal documents. There is no question that we proved loss causation under Dura. So the defendants come back and they say, well, you know, maybe they proved loss causation, but they haven't eliminated the market, the industry. Clearly we did. That's what the expert did in his analysis. So they say, well, there might have been non-fraud company-specific factors that the expert didn't consider. Well, that wasn't the testimony at trial. This expert took the stand. The defendants make some argument that he said, oh, those were included. Your Honors, that's just a red herring. They are included in the model. Everything's included in the model. Whether there's company-specific information, information that goes somewhere else, it's accounted for by the model. That's what the expert meant.
How?
It's accounted for, Your Honor, because you look at the in an event study at every day. Some of those days there might be an increase or a decrease that has
that's
nothing to do with it.
That's the specific disclosure method.
What that's
about,
correct, Your Honor.
What about
but
the
you
leakage
also,
method?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You also use the event study as part of your leakage quantification analysis. The specific disclosure drops are specifically included in the leakage quantification. And then the experts...
But do they control for firm-specific?
Yes, he said that he carefully examined each one of the days where there were residual returns, where there was some difference between...
Oh, right, he testified that he looked at those and that there were some that caused increases and some that caused decreases and they canceled each other out, but does the model account for that?
Well, I think the model, Your Honor, would initially lay out the dates where you had a look at that type of information. The model would show you whether there was any difference in price movement or if it just moved with the market. And then he did an analysis to look at those days to see whether there was some firm-specific company information that was not related to the fraud. He said he carefully examined it, and they canceled each other out. Now, I don't understand how we can stand here after 12 years of litigation and say that somehow you get judgment as a matter of law because you completely failed to cross-examine an expert witness. They didn't ask him any questions about it. They didn't say what days. I mean, they speculate here about July of 2001 or July of 2002. Why didn't they ask the expert those questions? That was the time. After 12 years of litigation, you don't get to say, hey, it didn't work the first time. At the first trial, we tried truth on the market. That's what they tried. And you know what? It didn't work for us.
I thought the expert testified that the models... both of them did not account for firm-specific non-fraud events. The regression analysis controlled for market-specific.
Market and industry, Your Honor. What I was saying is that there might be some days where you would still look at residual returns, and you know you might have to then look at it and say, was it company-specific information? So yes, the expert is applying his judgment at that point, if that's the question.
Right. It's not built into the statistical model.
Right. I think that the statistical model helps you look at which days you need to examine. That's what I guess I'm trying to say.
Okay. So the models do not account for firm. I mean, that's a given. Do not.
Right.
Neither model accounts
they don't.
For firm-specific.
They might identify days that you need to look at.
I'm sorry. Just indulge me. Wait till she finishes the answer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So we've stipulated to that, apparently, that the models do not account for firm-specific non-fraud events.
No, they wouldn't take it out. You have to look at it.
Okay.
And I think that, you know, if you look at cases like Lapsley or Havard, you know, you have to cross-examine the expert. You can't just say, you know, my failed litigation tactics, now I get a new shot because of an appeal.
Well, that presupposes that it's acceptable under Dura to measure loss causation in this way by addressing the firm-specific non-fraud events testimonially as opposed to through the statistical model. The plaintiff's argument or the defense argument is that the model is flawed for that very reason and can't be used.
I don't know that they've specifically said it that way, Your Honor.
I asked the question. They said they're looking for a categorical holding that this model is fatally flawed and can't be used for loss
causation. Well, I think Dura and Schleicher both recognize the possibility of leakage, that that's one of the things you look at. And I think what defendants miss is, in Schleicher, the court specifically talks about how, you know, when the truth comes out, the stock would drop. It talks about you can have a statement that increases inflation, or you can have a statement that prevents a decline. And, you know, when you look at this case, had the defendant said on any of the days where there was a false statement, we're predatory lenders, and we have masked our delinquency statistics, and we're committing a huge accounting fraud, the stock would have dropped.
Oh, sure. And the model measures the value of the truth. And the question is whether the full value is attributable to that first misrepresentation that the jury found, that March 23rd statement, which pertained to only one species of fraud. So it suggests that by attributing the full inflated value as of that date going forward, there was some duty to disclose the full truth, including all of the other species of fraud. Now, that might have kicked in 3 days later when the 10K filing was made, because, of course, when you make a government filing, you have to tell the whole truth. But, you know, for that first date, that was one statement made by one of the defendants in, as I understand it, a press release, I think, or
yes,
some
Runner,
such?
It was in an article in the Origination News.
Right. So how is the full value of the inflated price attributable to that statement?
I think, Your Honor, what happened here is that you have the statement. The first statement that the jury found was false was the March 23rd statement. It only related to predatory lending. The jury's back in the jury room, and they have to pick. Do we pick the leakage quantification, the specific disclosure quantification, or zero? And I think faced with a statement that only related to one of the three frauds, the jury was left to figure out which one best estimated the damages. They knew that the, you know, predatory lending was the largest component of the 2394. They understood defendants' internal documents, and they did the best they could in that circumstance. I think it only affects three trading days. It's March 23rd, the 26th, and the 27th. Once you get to the 28th, the defendants make statements that relate to all three frauds. The jury found all three frauds. And under Schleicher, at that point, had they told the truth, we're predatory lenders, we mask our delinquency statistics, and we're committing a big accounting fraud, the stock would have dropped. And so it's cured by that
day. By 2394 that day.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think
that's a theory anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think that, you know, what you have here is what the defendants are really arguing, and they don't argue it, is that there's not enough evidence to support the 2394 for just those 3 days. I mean, I think ultimately that's really the argument that, you know, they should have made and haven't here. They haven't even raised that as an issue, because what they're trying to do is take one day where the jury had to do the best they could and pick between three sets of numbers, and they're trying to take that to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's that simple. But it's by March 28th, you have a statement about all three frauds. I think that, you know, as to that issue, I think the defendants waived it. I mean, whatever interspersals of the yeses and noes mean, it's not, hey, you can't give them 2394 for predatory lending alone on March 23rd. And I think you have to raise that, because otherwise you find yourself in this position where we're up on appeal after 12 years arguing about something that you could have sent the jury back in to fix at the time. And that's why the waiver argument applies.
Well, the judge did let everybody know that all arguments attacking the verdict were preserved.
Your Honor, you're reading defendant's brief when you see that, because if you look at the record, what happened is that counsel raised the inconsistent interspersals of yeses and noes. Thereafter, Judge Guzman excused the jury, told him, your duty is done, and it says jury exits in the transcript. After that, defense counsel starts to address his 50A motions that he wants to raise, and the judge says those are preserved. I mean, Judge, you can't say that we put our faith in Judge Guzman, because the jury was already gone when he said that, and he was talking about a question about the 50A motion. And so I think it is waived. Plus, the case law in the Seventh Circuit says, you know, you can't rely on the judge. You need to make a motion to have the jury resume deliberations. And that wasn't done here. And the case law is clear in Cundiff and Barnes and Strauss that that's your obligation. You can't, it says something like, in one of those cases, a mutual error doesn't excuse you. I think that I want to get to the Janus issue just quickly, Your Honors. I think that if you look at March 23rd, which counsel spoke about here, it's Mr. Gilmer's statement. He testified at trial. I made the statement that day, and I made it other days as well. And, you know, they say, well, how can Aldinger be on the hook for it? Well, if you look at Janus, I think that you'll see that it says, you know, did you have ultimate authority over the statement? Did you have control over the contents, whether and how to communicate it? And if you go back and look, Mr. Gilmer's statement on March 23rd was something like predatory lending, we don't engage in it, it's abhorrent. That's what he said. His exact words came from a memo that Mr. Aldinger wrote in September of 2000, where he told household people, he CC'd Mr. Gilmer on the memo, and he said, when you're asked about predatory lending, this is what you should say. They're the identical, exact same words that Gilmer uttered 6 months later when he spoke to the markets.
So he furnished it, which is the Janus era.
I don't think that you can say furnished, Your Honor. I think that when you're the CEO of a company, he had ultimate authority. He's telling his employees what to say when asked about predatory lending. He said at trial that he gave that memo to Gilmer, and he said he approved it. That's what he said. That's what you were supposed to say from Mr. Aldinger's lips. This is what you're to say as household when asked about predatory lending, and that's exactly what Gilmer said. And I suspect that that may be why the jury found that Mr. Aldinger was knowing, but Mr. Gilmer reckless for uttering the statement. And so I think that when you look at a day like that, it's clear that under Janus, it's absolutely Mr. Aldinger's statement. I think that, you know, more importantly, in terms of showing prejudice, there is no prejudice. The jury didn't find these defendants liable for any statements made by a corporate spokesperson. The jury excluded 10 statements after March 23rd that were made by corporate spokespeople, perhaps because the instruction on making a statement, the specific instruction said make a statement. They let the defendants out on those. They only found the defendants liable for statements that one of the defendants made. And I think that...
Getting back to these, they had three alternatives. The $23 one, what were the other two?
Specific disclosure and zero. Those were their three choices that Judge Guzman gave them. We asked if we could just have the jury pick a reasonable estimate of damages. Defendants wanted all three. Judge Guzman decided to give all three. Say, you have to pick between these three. You can't just put in any number you want.
I'm glad about that.
I understand.
That would have been
I think that
really
in a lot of
speculative.
Cases you tell you... I'm sorry. I did it again. The reasonable estimate of damages. I think you do tell a jury that in some cases, and it may have helped.
Not a case like, I mean, this is, you got to have some expert support for the numbers in a case like this.
I understand, Your Honor, and I think we did. I think we did, clearly. I think that when you look at these statements, though, you know, for household, they're on the hook for all 17 statements. They were uttered by one of the defendants. Mr. Aldinger is on the hook because he concedes he made 15 of the 17 statements, and the other two, he's liable in any event under control person liability. I mean, the jury found he was a control person, so he gets hit for all 17. Mr. Shainholz was only found primarily liable for 16. 15 he concedes he made, and the other two he's liable under 20A. So the March 23rd issue doesn't even hit him. As to Mr. Gilmer, you know, I think, Your Honor, Mr. Gilmer says, well, you know, what about the SEC filings? I mean, Shainholz and Aldinger signed them, so you can certainly find them liable for those, but you can't find me liable for those. And I think the reality is that when you look, again, at the words of Janus, you look at the facts and circumstances, who had ultimate authority? There doesn't have to be just one maker. Did you have control over the contents and whether and how to communicate it? And the testimony in this case was that Mr. Gilmer was the vice chairman of the company in 2002. He was the head of the largest unit, the one that the fraud emanated from in this case. He also approved the content of all the SEC filings, and the CFO, Mr. Shainholz, testified, I took comfort in the fact that we got these approvals from the business heads. I think under Janus, you can find he made those statements. But in any event, it has no impact on the other three defendants because all three of them are on the hook for all 17 statements, no matter how you cut it. I mean, I understand the defendants raised some proportionate liability argument in their reply brief. I mean, I think that when you look at it, you know, proportionate liability, Janus doesn't talk about proportionate liability. The PSLRA and the jury instruction and the verdict form here that they don't challenge on this basis told the jury to analyze the defendant's conduct in apportioning liability, and certainly that's what the jury was entitled to do. You know, the last thing I want to talk to or discuss is, you know, I want to talk a little bit about rebutting the presumption. I think that it's, you know, one of the things that doesn't really come through in the briefs here is that in this case, you know, the defendants got a chance to rebut the presumption at trial. You know, when you go back and look at Basic versus Levinson, you know, and you take a look at it, it says there's really three ways that you could rebut the presumption of reliance. First, you know, you can say that market makers were privy to the truth. I mean, we don't really have that issue here because the defendants said nobody had inside information. And they had to say that because they were going to say they weren't predatory lenders, so how could somebody have inside information? Secondly, though, the main way that you can rebut the presumption of reliance is the truth on the market defense. That was the case that was tried here, Your Honor. When you asked earlier about questions about what was said in closing arguments, I think that's what the closing argument was about for the defendants. They said everybody knew. I mean, I remember the big charts. Everybody knew. And that was rejected by the jury in this case. When you look at Basic, that's the main way you rebut the presumption on a class-wide basis. They tried it, they lost it, as Judge Guzman noted after the trial. I think that then you come to the defendant's arguments with respect to, you know, well, we didn't really get a chance to attack particular class members. They did. They asked for the claim form question cut out 26% of the class. They asked for discovery, and they got it, Your Honors. They asked for 120 days. That's what Judge Guzman gave them. They were dilatory. They didn't use it very well. It's that simple. And they weren't able to sever that link between the decision to purchase the stock and the price that Basic requires you to do as to any one of those class members. I mean, if you look at, there's one document not cited in the briefs. It's clerk's docket 1777, where Judge Guzman says, hey, discovery's over. Now the defendants have to raise this issue. They have to show us there's a genuine issue of material fact. And they couldn't do that. I see my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Clement, how much time? You have 4 minutes, Mr. Clement.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to make 3 points in rebuttal. I'm going to start with whether we had some burden to do more on cross-examination. I think, first of all, Judge Sykes, you made the most important point, which is the models themselves simply do not account for the non-fraud firm-specific information. And that just means they're not good enough under Dura. Now, we think that's alone enough, as you suggested, but even if you can complement that or supplement that with other testimony, the testimony here doesn't cut it because it just says over the whole period it nets out, but it doesn't say that at specific times it nets out. And people are going to recover based on all of those day inflation, based on when they traded, they're going to recover for every single one of those days, even though lots of those days are going to reflect inflation that has nothing to do with the fraud. Now, on the cross-examination, I think in fairness to trial counsel, the reason there wasn't more cross-examination on this point is the trial counsel got the exact admission he was looking for. The last part of the exchange, and this is on page 8 of our reply brief, with the plaintiff's expert is the plaintiff expert says, but just to be clear, under the leakage model, whether they were purely fraud-related, combined fraud-related, or not at all fraud-related, they were all included in the leakage model. So when you're cross-examining an expert and he says there's a Dura era here, I think you're entitled to move on to the next topic, which is what happened. Now let's talk about March 23rd a little bit longer, because as part of the colloquy, the question became, well, on any one of these days, if the truth came out, then the price would drop that amount. But as I believe Your Honor pointed out, that can't be true about March 23rd. If the truth came out about predatory lending on March 23rd, nobody thinks the price would have dropped $24, because I think it's common ground that the $24 reflects the predatory lending fraud, the reaging fraud, the restatement fraud, and non-fraud firm-specific information. So if all that happened on March 23rd is the one misrepresentation the jury found would have been truthfully disclosed to the market, the price might have dropped, but it wouldn't have dropped $24. Now, they want to dismiss this as just, and you know, they're actually quite candid that the jury was presented with three options and none of them worked. Well, that's not true. I mean, zero would have worked. But so would have the specific disclosures model, because remember, the specific disclosure model ties inflation coming out to disclosures on specific days. Those disclosures were about specific frauds. So you can find, okay, here's $2 that's specifically associated with reaging, or here's $3 that's associated with predatory lending. You can't do that with the leakage model. And so the jury had a viable option, but they picked one that just doesn't work. Now, it's not just sort of a, well, you know, it's three trading days, we can ignore it. Because as we suggest, what it really shows is it shows the broader problem with this model. If the jury would have come back and said the first misrepresentation was on December 4th, 2001, they would have attributed the entire amount of inflation to reaging. If instead of coming out with 423, they would have come up with May 9th, 2001, they would have attributed everything to reaging and restatement and not a penny to predatory lending. What that shows is this model was not designed to account for a single fraud, but it was also not designed to be able to differentiate the effects of non-fraud firm-specific information. Let me close with just the Janus error. What you heard is maybe an argument that under the most elastic reading of Janus, there might be a possible theory to get Aldinger as the maker of a statement. That's not the test. Essentially, if you recognize there's a Janus error, then the question is prejudice. The question on prejudice is much more forgiving for my clients. It basically says, can you show that that this error didn't have an effect?
I thought there were some stipulations here that might create a prejudice problem for your side of the case. Weren't there stipulations about who was the maker of the 10K statements and the 10Q statements?
Your Honor, there was a stipulation that the 10Ks, the 10Qs, and the company press releases were made by Household. But that doesn't create any kind of problem here for showing prejudice. And the easiest way to explain that is, but there's two ways I'd like to try, and I know my time is up, but I'm trying to be responsive to this question. The first is that the critical statement, I think, for showing prejudice to Household is the March 23rd statement. And that's a statement in Origination News by Gilmer, and there's no stipulation as to that statement. So the stipulation only goes to 10Ks, 10Qs, and company press releases, not statements like that from Gilmer. And that statement is so critical because of all the findings the jury made, they only made one knowing finding for Aldinger on the 23rd, which is then passed up to Household on the 23rd. So every other finding the jury makes is recklessness. And the difference between recklessness and knowing is entirely prejudicial under the PSLRA, because under 21DF2 of the PSLRA, if you are found to have made a knowing statement, you can be jointly and severably liable. But if there's no knowing statement, then you are only liable for your proportional share. So that's the so.
And the verdict was not sliced and diced in that way here?
It was sliced and diced, and I want to get that actually gets to the second so prejudice. So what happens is the verdict has knowing reckless for each one of the counts.
Right.
The only one there's knowingness is this March 23rd.
Okay.
There is an assignment that's a generic assignment to the whole form that deals with proportional liability. And that gives 55% to Household. So if there's no knowing statement here, Household's liability is capped at 55%. If there is a knowing statement, there's the possibility of joint and several liability. That difference seems to me more than sufficient to show prejudice, and it's to a statement that the stipulation doesn't touch. If I could just finish, the other way that there's prejudice is gets right to that proportionality, because the jury's instructed on proportionality to look at essentially all of the conduct of the defendants. And that has to include, because as every one of these statements, including ones that shouldn't be attributed to people, they're making judgments that, yes, oh, Gilmer acted recklessly with the statement. So then when they get to making the proportional share, they're clearly influenced by whether they think certainly the individual defendants have made or not made certain statements, and they attribute that all up, and it's got to equal 100%. It's clearly prejudicial inter se among the individuals, and if they're entitled to a new trial on that basis, you have to give a new trial to Household as well.
Just to clarify your bottom line request, looking for a new trial on just lost causation and this question of the Janus error and proportionality, or even the questions of the basic actionability of the statements, because those I didn't see any argument about that.
Right. I think, to be clear, though, we believe we'd be entitled to a new trial. We'd be entitled to a new trial on all those issues. Those issues may not be the subject of the vigorous contesting of the parties on remand, but we still think we're entitled to a new trial. Obviously, in the strong form of the loss causation argument, we think we'd be entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under